Welcome to the Molecular Ecologist Podcast. This is a brand new project, sort of an experiment for us. The idea we have is that we are going to get together a panel of contributors to the Molecular Ecologist blog, which covers ecology, evolution, and everything in between. And we're going to discuss the science that we've been reading and writing about. For our inaugural podcast episode, we're going to be discussing whale gut microbes and digestion of complex molecules, genetic load in alpine ibexes, the history of African-American contributions in evolutionary biology, and the population genetics of two very cryptic crow species. I'm Jeremy Yoder. I'm the Molecular Ecologist blog editor, and I'm an assistant professor of biology at Cal State Northridge in Los Angeles. And joining me today are...
I'm Kelly Friel. I'm a postdoc at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology at UH Manoa off the island of Oahu and working with Mike Rapay.
Hi, my name is Patricia Pochnerova. I'm a postdoc at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, and I work with the Statistical and Population Genetics Group.
Hi, and I'm Arshon Abrams. I am a PhD candidate at the University of Missouri studying phylogenomics in the Pairs Lab.
Cool. Thanks everybody for joining us. I'm really excited about this. So let's dive in. Kelly, so this past month you wrote about some new work on whale guts.
Yeah. So I actually highlighted an article that was led by Carolyn Miller, and she's at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, so known as HUI. And it was one of the articles that was highlighted by an ISNI list. And I love kind of these top papers lists because it's a fun way to kind of review stuff that's not only in my wheelhouse, but also things that are a little bit farther afield. So that includes whale guts. So I study microbe things, but definitely not whale poop in any capacity. So to jump into the study that I covered, it's really the big picture is thinking about carbon transport and how little tiny things in the ocean, like krill and copepods, as well as huge things in the ocean like whales, are contributing to biogeochemical cycling. So as anyone might guess, it's really, really hard to study things in the ocean. From anything, just if you want to collect some sediments a couple kilometers down, that's going to be pretty tricky. To look at organisms like whales, that's incredibly difficult. And one of the cool things about this study was that the authors were able to collaborate with Native Alaskan subsistence samples from whale guts. So their question was really, whales eat lots of tiny things like krill and copepods. How is that carbon that they're eating getting back into the system? And many people might guess that's poop for the most part. And these tiny critters, particularly copepods, are really rich in a lipid known as a wax ester. So the wax esters are really difficult to digest. So many other marine vertebrates can't digest them very well. They make up to 80% of the lipid content in these whales' food. So clearly really important. And interestingly, bowhead whales, which was the focus of this study, and some other baleen whales are really good at digesting these wax esters. So the authors were really asking, what's going on? Why can they digest them so well? So as I mentioned, they were able to collaborate with Native Alaskan hunters, and they ended up with over 4 years, 38 whales in total that they were able to sample along the GI tract. So that's just thinking about the access to these really unique samples is cool. Throughout the GI tract, they essentially looked at the lipid composition as it changed, as well as the microbial community as it changed. So as kind of a caveat, this is really a correlation study. There's more work to be done to really understand the functional role of the microbes and exactly how they're processing these wax esters. But it's really cool because at the end of the GI tract, we go from 80% wax esters present to about 30%. So a huge majority of them are being digested by the microbes. And the authors found a really strong connection between shifts in the bacterial community and this decrease in the wax esters present. So as the corresponding author said, this is a really unique glimpse into a previously hidden part of the marine food web. And so that's why I found it pretty interesting and kind of a fun study to highlight.
Is it me or is that a a little bit cleaner story than you often get with these microbial community studies.
Oh, yes. Microbial community studies can go all sorts of different directions. And I mean, there's also questions as to what you can take from the data that you get. So there's all sorts of things going on there. But I thought this was pretty clean. You see a change in the microbial community that was pretty clear in these different sections of the GI tract. And I also had never learned anything about the whale GI tract. So more fun things there. They have some really cool figures that they include that make it pretty clear.
Mm-hmm. The color-coded intestine is a great touch.
My favorite, yes.
And this is, I guess, a broader question for microbial community ecology. But what would take this to a more causally informed format than sort of the matching community composition with nutrient content in the gut?
Right. So, well, for what they did, they looked at just the 16S, so they did an amplicon sequencing approach. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you could do to try to get at it without trying to go down the road of cultivating these microbes, which I've never tried to do any gut cultivation, but I assume that's quite difficult just to try to replicate the environment that they need to live in a lab. But you could also do some metagenomic sequencing, where you end up trying to put together some metagenome assembled genomes, and from that look at what functional genes you have in those different sort of population level genomes that you might be able to pull out. Oftentimes when you have a slightly less diverse community, so versus maybe a soil community or something like that, you're able to put together a few more of those MAGs as they're known. So that could be one way to go down the road of trying to understand the function a little bit better without needing to grow any of these bacteria or study them in situ. But I think I'm not an expert in lipid degradation, but it seems that it's one of the problems. It's a little bit of a mystery exactly how these wax esters are degraded by the bacteria.
Oh, okay. So there might even be some pretty there might not be very good
questions there. So I'm not an expert here. So, but it seemed that was also another challenge in understanding what's going on.
Cool. Well, that is super interesting stuff. Okay. Well, let's move along to Patricia. You are talking about pretty endangered. Actually, I don't know this. I'm not a mammalogist. Are ibex goats properly?
Yeah.
Okay.
I hope. Right. Exactly. So I'm going to be talking about alpine ibex and a study that was published in Nature Communications. It's about genetic load and purging. Mm-hmm. And I think it comes right in this time when these things are going to become very important in general. All the populations, or not all, but many of them are going to become more and more fragmented, isolated, small, and we still don't really understand what's going to happen. So I think it's a great time to be doing this kind of science, because for once we have the tools, we have the data, we can finally start looking at these things in wild populations, in natural populations, rather just kind of theorizing about what might be happening. So I found it really interesting because they moved the field a little bit further, I think. Mm-hmm. So I think the main question that somehow still is open out there is how much there's accumulation of genetic load and how much there's happening of purging. There's a lot of a lot of discussion about this, I would say, in the field right now. There are some studies that show us that genetic load accumulates, like a very typical example is the study of the woolly mammoth, and the study by Rebecca Rogers and Motis Litkin to show that one of the very last woolly mammoths had a lot of deleterious mutations. On the other hand, we have a study about the Channel Island foxes, which seem to have burst the highly deleterious mutations. and survive, even though they have very low genomic diversity. So this is the kind of time where we still don't really know what determines what and what's the impact and so on. And the study by Christine Grossen and colleagues looks at a population of ibex which has been through a huge bottleneck. They went to below 100 individuals in the beginning of the 19th century, and now they are back to about 50,000 individuals. And throughout this period, they also went through a number of reintroductions. So it's kind of interesting because you have a population which started from one single remaining population of less than 100 individuals in Gran Paradiso in Italy, and now they are all over the place. There are populations which have been started from a previously reintroduced population. So you have from two up to four different bottlenecks. And you can look at how much genetic diversity is left, how much genetic load has accumulated over time, you know, throughout the different bottlenecks. And that's exactly what they do. They have 60 genomes from six different wild goat species plus domestic goat. And they compare the species, and then later on they also compare the different populations and the different reintroduced populations of the alpine ibex in particular. And they use a whole battery of different tests to look at the deleterious mutations. They look at the effect of genetic mutations through variant prediction. They look at the GERP scores and our assumption of what are conserved regions where the mutations are assumed to be particularly deleterious or disadvantages. And they also use transcriptomic data to look at genes that have been pseudogenized. So this way they identify the mutations that we consider highly deleterious, and then look at basically the proportions in the different species and in the different populations. And what they find is that for most cases, that the alpine ibex has more of a moderately deleterious modifier mutations, but they have less of the highly deleterious mutations. So there is evidence of purging of this. So this is mostly in comparison to the Iberian ibex, but also then within the populations of alpine ibex, we can see that the more number of bottlenecks the populations went through, the less diversity they have, the more runs of homozygosity they have, and also the more genetic load they have, except for the very highly deleterious mutation category, where the population which went through the most number of bottlenecks, which is four, has actually far less deleterious mutations, suggesting that even though this population doesn't have much diversity left, there has been some purging going on, which managed to kind of save the population in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think this is kind of interesting because it tells us that that somehow populations do manage to purge the worst in a way, mm-hmm. and that there's hope in some ways. And it also kind of opens a lot more questions, but I think it helps us a lot to understand what is happening, and that basically there's hope for species to survive because
so is the thought is that is actually that's effective selection. I suppose it must be removing highly deleterious mutations, which is
exactly Yeah, purging is basically just the extra selection operating when once in the homozygous state, all these highly deleterious mutations are revealed.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Right. So you have this sort of two-pronged effect of losing population diversity. On the one hand, there's the possibility for accumulation of deleterious mutations, but on the other hand, they're more likely to be exposed
revealed,
as homozygous.
Exposed. Exactly. And then selection can see them and can more effectively remove them. So that's one of the points of the whole discussion, because I mean, one of the assumptions is that in the small populations, the selection is not as effective, right? The genetic drift kind of rules. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, how much purifying selection power there is still remaining. Can the selection still operate on these highly deleterious variants and remove them or not? That's basically the still open question. And this study kind of tells us that in case of the highly deleterious mutation, it is there, it can help, while you can still see the sort of mildly deleterious load accumulating anyway. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't say that they are fine, but at least the immediately negative effects are removed. But in the long term, we still don't really know how this mild genetic load is going to affect the population.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. That's so many just classic population genetics results kind of coming together in this one, theory coming together in this one empirical study, and this really nice series of populations with qualitatively different degrees of expected drift.
Yeah, precisely. It's very nice that they have this data, and it's a population which has been under a lot of monitoring because people have been always interested in hunting alpine ibex, and this was one of the reasons why they were restored and why people know where they were introduced, how many individuals, and basically there's all the records needed to kind of monitor the population. So then you can more easily also follow up and connect it with the genetic data and look at the fitness of the population.
Nice. Cool. So this is clearly sort of the flowering of genomic data in conservation biology. We're getting finer and finer grain detail about the effects of population reduction and fragmentation. And they're not good, but they're
At least we know.
Yeah. We're better understanding what needs to be done, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so far it's been mostly this has been mostly done kind of on the theoretical level, right? And if not, then on model species. But only now with genomic data and bioinformatic tools, we can really make these kinds of studies in wild populations and look at it kind of in the real world.
Cool.
I have a really quick question. Perhaps you covered it and I missed it, but how many animals did they have to sample to be sure about their results, like for it to be statistically significant?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's also one of the cases in this study. The number of individuals they have for the different populations is variable. But then what they did was, for example, for the comparison between the alpine ibex and Iberian ibex, they downsampled it. So and did also bootstrapping. So then you do a comparison basically on the level of the population with the lowest number of samples. Gotcha. And it kind of depends on the analysis. Sometimes you can do this individual level analysis to avoid the problem. Mm-hmm. But yeah, of course, more sample size would be nice, but that's also one of the problems with these populations. You often have so few individuals existing, right, that it's even more difficult to get good sample size.
Always a challenge.
Yeah.
All right. Another great paper. Let's move along to Sean then. And your really really great retrospective last month on African Americans in our field.
As any good grad student, I was doing a lot of reading last year on the history of my field, trying to get a little inspired, and I think particularly for people of color, that can often be a little dubious. While you do find really great science and you find cool stories and great discoveries, you can also find a lot of milkshake ducks. Are you familiar? you'll find a scientist who's really cool, and then they were a eugenicist. Okay, so and that really that disparity. You know, on one hand, it made me want to, you know, seek out other scientists like me to see if they were having similar feelings. And I also wanted to see, you know, and in doing that, I realized there weren't a whole lot of us around and actively trying to search. So last year, sometime I came across, in looking for more scientists, I came across Dr. Graves, Dr. Joseph Graves, article on the recent history of African Americans in evolutionary biology, he being the first African American scientist to receive his PhD in evolutionary biology in 1988. He wasn't by any means the first African American biologist. You know, African Americans had been participating in biology throughout all of the 20th century, and when the field of evolutionary biology was kind of coming together sometime in the early 20th century, they were practicing biologists, but for a lot of different reasons, they weren't engaged in evolutionary biology. He points to a few different reasons for this, both being the ideas at the time of eugenics and things, particularly in the U.S., that inspired some of the horrible atrocities we know from World War II and Nazi uses of or abuses of science, right? But he takes that perspective and points to himself as being maybe the start of a tipping point. Following his degree, only five other African-American biologists received their degrees in evolutionary biology, their PhDs in evolutionary biology, and that's spanning a decade, right? And so, just to name them, since I could count them on my hand, this was Dr. Scott Edwards, who I actually referenced in my article, because I had an encounter with him at a workshop that really defined an early part of my PhD, Dr. Tyrone Hayes from Harvard University, Dr. Colette St. Mary, notably the first African-American woman to receive a PhD in evolutionary biology, Dr. Paul Turner from who in 1995 got their degree from Michigan State. And then Dr. Charles Richardson, who actually after doing a short postdoc, following getting his PhD, stopped doing science. And you think about like the people who fall out of science over time and people who aren't able to continue doing good research, and it's on one thing to think of it a macro scale, but when there's only five in a decade, it can hit a little close to home. But even giving that, since then we've had an increasing number of African Americans in evolutionary biology, but Dr. Graves estimates it only at being around 0.3%, where the average for biologists is 3%, and the expectation of under racial equity would be around 10%, because African Americans make up around 10% of the U.S. population.
Mm-hmm.
So thinking about all these things, so what are still some of the factors that are contributing to African Americans not being included? Now, he does debunk some theories regarding religiosity, suggesting that some people have suggested that maybe Africans are more religious than other groups. And when looked, it does not seem to really be the case. And in fact, you can teach evolutionary biology in a religious context, and many religious faiths are evolutionary biology are pro-evolution in a lot of ways. What he really tends to nail down as a distinct cause is a lack of representation. So yes, it's a bit of a cycle. If you don't have black evolutionary biologists, African American evolutionary biologists, then you don't have the people for the young biologists to look up to and to potentially enter into the field. And of course, there are great mentors across racial, gender, ethnic lines. But nothing can replace the idea of seeing yourself in a specific position. And he offers a lot of great tools that we might use to addressing our own internalized racism, whether that is hopefully not biological racism as he defines, but potentially aversive racism or colorblind racism, or just even the fear of colorblind racism can lead to disparities for underrepresented groups broadly, not just African Americans, but also including Native Americans and Latinx community. And he talks about how we can put forward those African-Americans or those underrepresented groups to be more visible in terms of our evolutionary biology teachings, right? Whether it's showing documentaries in these classes that highlight work like Dr. Graves, his work in aging. He's been in several documentaries, including, with alongside researchers like Wooten and Gould, who he really looked up to as anti-racist evolutionary biologists, those biologists who looked at evolutionary biology as a means for ending discrimination and truly understanding the diversity of the human population. So it was a very inspiring read. I encourage everyone to take some time. This was in the Journal of Evolution Education and Outreach. Definitely take some time to look at it and maybe think about how we as researchers can be impacting the next generation and what the next generation of scientists look like.
Cool. Yeah. It's not surprising, but it is still astonishing that you are able to name people in this fairly wide range of time who were African Americans who received PhDs in the field.
Yeah, it's right. Crazy. I had no idea.
Mm-hmm. I didn't make it there. That was a really good write-up that you put together.
Yeah, quite eye-opening.
So I teach evolutionary biology as a part of our core curriculum, and one of the things I try to think about is not just how I'm representing the diversity of people working in the field. That I still need to work on, but I struggle with how exactly to present the history of evolutionary thought, which is it's certainly been misappropriated in clear ways by white supremacists, but there are also folks who made major contributions to the field who were straight up unalloyed racists. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Dr. Graves' article had suggestions about framing or emphasis in that sort of thing. My strategy mostly has been to make snarky asides whenever I have to talk about Ronald Fisher, for example.
Yeah, and there are definitely, and I think. Even as soon as this article came out, there was like some statements from some biologists in the UK that I was like, oh, great, timely. during Black History Month of all times. No, but I think, part of being in the age of information that we are in and in misinformation, right, is being able to understand people as their full humans, and the scientists as capable of bias, as well as great discoveries, right? And mm-hmm. I don't think we necessarily have to not talk about the work that they did. Maybe we don't need to put them up on as much of a pedestal. I think maybe it is a problem when we're having lessons of intro biology and we just have, photos of old white men again and again and again, and then that is what is being translated, when we can talk about the work without necessarily showing them, or we can talk about contemporary work or ways in which research now is being addressed so you can contextualize it in the people who are doing research today, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering, Sean, what's your kind of feeling about how the situation is today? Like, do you feel, during your years at the university, have you experienced, like, whether you feel it's moving forward in this area and it's getting better at all?
I feel like it must be getting better. I know a lot of young biologists, young Black biologists who I see as my contemporaries, people who are maybe 5-8 years ahead of me. So hopefully there is a higher density of us coming into the field and can be visible for other people who are interested in the field. I think part of that is the internet being available for people to to look up and to become inspired by things in ways that they weren't necessarily able to before. Mm-hmm. So I definitely think we're getting better, but I also don't think it is a straight line, right? We could very easily get worse if we let it fall through our focus.
The work's not done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Twitter will tell you that. Work's not done.
Oh, yeah. So the last topic for the cast is this paper, one of the papers that I read and wrote about last month. It's kind of a great vindication if you have been even a casual birder in the general the Pacific Northwest. So there have been for quite a while. It's been understood that there are two species of crows. It basically overlapping down the Pacific coast of Canada and Alaska. And coming into contact, particularly around Vancouver and Seattle, the Puget Sound area. But the differences, the field marks that distinguish these two different crow species are that one of them, the Northwestern crow, is slightly smaller than the other, the American crow, and sounds a little different when it crows. And so I personally have had the experience multiple times of visiting Seattle or Vancouver, or I lived in Vancouver for a bit and telling a non-biologist about this and then pointing to a crow and being completely unable to tell them which species I was looking at. The first paper that really addresses this with modern genetic data was published ahead of print online at Molecular Ecology recently. So a group led by David Slager at the University of Washington collected mitochondrial DNA sequence data and a bunch of nuclear SNPs using RadSeq or DDRadSeq from samples all through the range of what has been understood to be the Northwestern crow and then adjacent populations that are understood to be purely American crows in British Columbia, Washington, Idaho, and down as far as California. And what they find are that there are in fact two mitochondrial haplotype lineages that look like they correspond to the two different crows. But in the nuclear data, there is a lot of hybridization going on. And probably what is more accurate to describe the diversity of the Northwestern crows is there's a just a real nice isolation by distance climb from Juneau up in the north down to Seattle in the south. So there are individuals that are carrying Northwestern crow haplotypes that have a lot of American crow nuclear genetic variants. And these are not, none of the crows in the data set, it's not a huge data set, but it's respectable. None of the samples were first generation hybrids. So these are individuals that have, there's been back crossing and back crossing going on to generate the pattern that they're seeing here. And that vindicates ornithologists who have said for about as long as people have thought that they were two separate species, that really the body size differentiation of Northwestern crows looks kind of like a cline from the north down to the south. And so I don't know whether this means there's going to be any change to the to birding manuals, but it is consistent with there being quite a bit of hybridization, and these are probably not good biologically separate species. Although the two mitochondrial lineages are consistent with differentiation, and one of the things that they think might be going on is that there was a period where they were separated during the last glacial maximum. And this is actually a pattern that we see in other species along the Alaskan and Canadian Pacific coast. There were pockets basically of warmer climate out on the coast. So even when the interior was much, much colder or even glaciated, there were coastal refugia where populations could persist. And so we see patterns consistent with that, for example, in lodgepole pine across British Columbia. I thought that was a nice genetic context for some natural history that's a pretty old story.
Yeah, but what's the social system in crows? Do you know? Like what?
Oh, well, they're quite sociable. I'm far from an expert, but you know, you see, they're corvids. They're pretty cognitively advanced for birds. They seem to recognize each other and maybe even have calls that are associated with individuals. They famously are able to recognize human faces and may even be able to pass along word about people who disturb nests or otherwise irritate them, and you'll have whole flocks going after people who have a bad history with them. Or whole flocks that are really happy to see people who have fed them.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, I think this says a lot about regional preferences, because I feel like all the stories I know about, you know, are they two species, are they not two species, are on the other end of monophyletic reptiles in like iguanas, where you see big iguanas in Florida and then small iguanas in islands, and they're two species. No, in fact, they're just one species that has separated because of storms or hurricanes or something along those lines. So I mean, it's a great testament to how repeatable a lot of these inconsistencies can be.
Oh, uh-huh. Yeah, and I will say, I mean, I'm not properly a member of the ornithology community. I don't want to shade birders too much, but there is a little bit of motivation, I think, for counting more species than not.
Yeah, and when I was working in the herbarium in high school, like a nerd, I learned a lot about lumpers and splitters and the people mm-hmm. and the wars that ensue between. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, we have a lot of what are cryptic species, right? Where mm-hmm. we feel like, oh, maybe there is a species boundary here, and because they're not different in size, we're not able to clearly define them without genetic tools.
Yeah, it's always it's informative about human biases when we're surprised by the results from genetics, I think, sometimes.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Cool. Well, I think that wraps it up for this first cast. Thanks for joining me, everybody. I think this went well.
Yeah.
Thanks.
We'll see what kind of response we get. If you are listening to us right now, you can find full blog posts about all of these topics at molecularecologist.com. You can follow us on Twitter at @molecologist. All one mashed together word for updates from the site, or on Facebook at The Molecular Ecologist. Until next time we do this, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you then.